Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
Sedano with here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance and brought to you by my friends at My Computer Career, training for a better life. Will Perdue, four-time champion in the NBA, three with the Bulls, one with the Spurs, was a Jordan teammate for their first three championships, will join us here. He works for NBC Sports Chicago as one of the Bulls analysts now on their game broadcasts. And Will, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk over the last couple of weeks about Jordan and his teammates and pushing his teammates and fighting with his teammates. So naturally, the first question here has to be, what was your incident with Michael Jordan like?
Well, we had an incident, and quite honestly, I forget what year it was. As I've gotten older, things are starting to get a little, you know, hazy.
Yeah.
But we had an incident where in the second unit, we were running a play with, I think it was Milwaukee, what they were doing as we were preparing for the playoffs, if I remember correctly. And what we were doing is showing MJ in the first unit that they were going to continue to run Michael off a lot of screens, regardless of who he was guarding, whether it was Alvin Robinson or somebody else. That I was always the guy that set the first screen. So I might have set an illegal screen or two, and Michael got mad about it. And after one of them, when I knocked him down, he popped up and he said, "Listen, if you do that again, I'm going to punch you." And I was a little surprised by that. I know how competitive he is, but usually when you do stuff like that, he's like, "Yeah, do it again. Come on." You know, it's almost challenging. So that was kind of an interesting response from him, not one way that used to hearing. But as soon as he said it, Johnny Bach, who is the defensive coach per se, said, "Run it again." So I was like, well, if he says he's going to punch me, I better make sure I get my money's worth. So I ran over there. I don't even think I stopped. I ran right through him, knocked him to the ground. He jumped up, popped me in across the side of the head and kind of dazed me for a second. And then once I realized what happened, I started to go after him, but I got grabbed from behind and was told that that probably wasn't a good idea. I'm not sure I would have caught him anyways. But the other thing is people don't understand. I mean, now it wasn't common for, you know, fists to be thrown, for punches to happen. But there was always a lot of verbal sparring. There were guys going at each other. There was pushing and shoving. It was an intense environment. It was abrasive at times, but it was very competitive. And I always try to tell people, you know, there's five spots on the floor for starters. The other seven guys are vying for those spots, and most of them feel like they deserve those spots. So there was a lot going on of guys pushing each other as far as to get better. And that's what made this team so good was the competitive nature and the intensity of which we practice with.
How much did that help you as far as the edge that was concerned and needed maybe to go into particular series against some of these teams you were playing?
Oh, I know it helped me a lot. I mean, it took me a while, A, to adapt, B, to gain the respect of Michael and my teammates. But I thought it made everybody, you know, mentally tougher, but also physically the expectations of what we were going to have almost made the game seem secondary, made the game seem easier because of the fact that we were so prepared because we had already seen this, kind of like seen that, done that. So it wasn't like, okay, got to ramp it up now because it's a game. It was like, hey, just like in practice, guys, we got to play with the same intensity. We got to compete and we'll be okay.
Will Perdue joining us here. How do you feel that would be received in today's day and age?
Well, it's been interesting to see. You've had more than one player, whether it be on Twitter, whether it be on Instagram, talk about how, oh, hey, you know, I'd have something to say about that. I'd have to square off with Michael or some other teammate. And I thought Michael said something that was pretty intriguing. You know, it was either at the end of episode 7 or 8 when he got pretty emotional. What exactly have you won? You can't really say anything until you win something. And if you don't like it, then you can go elsewhere, or I don't need you, however it was. The interesting thing is I sit here and I tell people, yes, it was abrasive. Yes, it was borderline over the top. I said him the thing that, you know, I called him an a-hole, said he crossed the line. But at the same time, we were in a situation we recognized as teammates that this wasn't different. This just wasn't a regular team. This was a legitimate contender. We had the best player on the planet. He was giving us an opportunity to win a championship. So maybe we took our lumps more than we should have. Maybe we put up with more you-know-what than we should have. But because we knew what the ultimate goal was, because we knew we had a legitimate chance to do that, and how many teams actually have a legitimate chance to win a championship? And then we did. And you saw Bill Winnington say the approach worked. Phil Jackson allowed it. It worked. And I know it made me a better player, but it also helped me as an individual truly understand what being able to compete at that level meant.
Will Perdue joining us here. How would you best characterize Phil's relationship with Michael and juxtapose it to maybe how he treated the rest of the group?
Well, that was the thing that, actually helped a lot of guys. We knew Michael was different. We all know that in the NBA, stars are treated differently. I mean, the whole thing with Dennis. I mean, I was traded for Dennis. They brought Dennis in. They told Dennis, listen, we don't necessarily need you to be at every practice. And if you miss a practice, we'll just fine you and we'll keep going. But there are certain practices we need you at. And if you're not here, we'll come get you. And as you saw, that they did that numerous times. Hey, it's important for him to be here at this practice. And his place was across the street. So Michael went and got him one time. Wally, the assistant trainer, went and got him numerous times. So they allowed Dennis to be Dennis. But at the same time, Michael was Michael. Scotty was Scotty. But he would call Michael out in film sessions and talk to him about how he jeopardized the defense and how a bucket is on him because he made a mistake or he tried to dive into the passing lane and get a steal. And when he didn't get it, it was now 5-on-4. So guys appreciated how Phil handled the situation with Michael, how Phil made him accountable just like everybody else. As far as accountability, he wasn't held above higher than anybody else. He was held to the same standards as everybody else. Now, because he was Michael, he was treated a little differently. But we all know this is the NBA. LeBron's treated differently. Kobe's treated differently. Steph Curry's treated differently. That's no different. Those are things you have to adjust to. If that's going to bother you, you won't be able to play in this league.
Will Perdue joining us here. Will, there's been numerous examples throughout the episodes in the documentary about how crazy competitive he was, even off the court. Is there a story that comes to mind that maybe hasn't been shown that you just sat there and was like, this dude is just insane?
I mean, we've talked about the card games. You know, one of the things that I talked about, I haven't really mentioned it, but we used to do these things where instead of being fined when you're late or something, we had what were called silly fines. And then if you were late in a 5-minute window, you could pay a fine that would go into the kitty. And when the kitty got a certain amount of money in it, usually $500, $600, $700, all of a sudden Phil would come out and we'd have a shooting game at the end of practice. And he would lay the money out across the half court. And then you get 3 captains or 4 captains and then pick teams. You get first, the first guy gets the first pick, the third guy, the fourth guy gets the fourth and the fifth pick, and you go back and forth. And then you do shooting games, and the first team to win 3 games gets the money at half court, and Phil would lay it out. And if Michael didn't win, he was hot. There were times where he'd run by and just scatter the money all over the place or get mad at the guys that he picked, and then Phil would be like, how can you get mad? That's who you picked. It wasn't like we assigned those guys to you. But that's just, I mean, he hated to lose. And that's what I talk about from a competitive nature. Win at all costs, George. I know a lot of people talk about that, but he truly would make any sacrifice necessary to win at all costs. And I know, again, guys talk about it, but I think that's truly what separates him from everybody else.
Will Perdue joining us here. Will, when you played in all those series, which is the one that stood out the most to you before you even got to the finals? Like the team that you said, this was the team that was our biggest nemesis. Because you played the Knicks 6 times. Clearly you had to go through the Pistons. But if you had to pick one team that you felt was your biggest nemesis during that time, which would it be?
Well, I think it was the Pistons because So that championship in 91 is 3 years in the making. Lost to them in 89, lost to them in 90, and then finally beat them in 91. But it was learning how to play their physical style of basketball, learning how to maintain your composure while playing that style of basketball, but also realizing that you had to take a bit of what they do and a lot of what you do, meaning run the triangle, depend on your defense, you know, don't get sucked in, you know, use your response to their physicality and wisely. You know, at times you could get carried away and then you responding to what they did could really hurt you. So that's like a negative, and you compound it with another negative. And once we got past them, it wasn't like, hey, it's free sailing. But that was kind of what got us over the hump. That was the confidence booster that we need. And that was kind of, you know, especially when we swept them, that kind of told us we really are this good. We really have something special here.
What was it like when he was gone and Scotty was running the show? How much different was it?
You know, the practices weren't as abrasive. The intensity wasn't as high. They were still as competitive. And Phil did a really nice job because it was almost like more Phil had to step up and be more of a leader instead of a coach, or should I say be both. Scotty was still a leader, but he wasn't as vocal as Michael. He took a different approach with Michael. He took a more nurturing, brotherly type approach than, you know, the teacher that's trying to always teach you a lesson, the hard ass. So, you know, things were just different, maybe a little more at ease. There wasn't as much tension. But by that time, though, we had already learned. We had already, you know, taken the lessons from not only Michael, but from Phil, from Johnny Bach, that now we were more mature and we understood what it took. But also probably the biggest difference, George, was the trust that we had to have in each other, because we really had to lean on each other because we didn't have MJ to bail us out if things didn't go well. And we really had to lean on and trust the offense and the defensive schemes that the coach has made for us.
Lastly here, Will Perdue joining us, and thanks again, Will, for joining us. Obviously, you guys, you know, you won those first couple championships. You saw them win the championships after you win San Antonio. You won one on your own. If you look at the entirety of that run, whose legacy, individual player legacy, was altered the most because of your teams, those Bulls teams?
Well, I think Scottie Pippen. You know, first of all, you hear Michael talk about, you know, without Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan doesn't win six championships. True. Unfortunately, the dance, in my opinion, has kind of painted Scottie in a little bit of a negative light because of the mistakes that he made. And listen, those were ill-timed, unfortunate mistakes. You know, the 1.8 seconds, you know, delaying his surgery so he doesn't have to play the whole season and miss training camp. Some say they're monumental, but at the same time, we as his teammates knew who he was. We knew how good he was. He didn't shoot the ball very well, but he was the second leading scorer behind Michael. He was the second leading rebounder behind Dennis by a small margin. He led the team in assists and he led the team in steals, and I think he led the team in minutes. So I think that there tells you how important he was. But I think people need to stop focusing on the negative. I think you have to understand he made mistakes, but also think about how important he was to this team. And because of that, he is now considered a top 50 player of all time. And I fully agree with that.
Well said. Will Perdue, four-time champion, three with the Bulls, one with the Spurs, with NBC Sports in Chicago doing Bulls broadcast. Will, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Well, George, I appreciate it. I just don't know what we're all going to be doing next weekend. We're going to have a withdrawal.
Well, you know what? At ESPN, we've got new documentaries. There's the Maguire Sosa coming up. There's a Bruce Lee one coming up. There's a Lance Armstrong one coming up. It'll be every Sunday. There'll be a new documentary for us. So there you go.
There you go. Unfortunately, it won't be titled The Last Dance.
No, definitely not. But thanks again, Will.
Right.
Thanks. Appreciate
you
it.
You got it.
Will Perdue hanging out with us here on the Sedano Show. That was great stuff, man. That was fantastic. Coming up next, two things. One, the NBA could be on track for a season. However, there's a huge question they're talking about when it comes to next season. We'll tell you what that is in just a moment. And Chuck E. Cheese is trying to fool people. What does that all mean? You'll get it in 3 minutes. Sit down over here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. So anyway, Andrea Kramer is going to join us in 15 minutes. We'll talk more Last Dance with her. But a couple of things. Have you seen the story about Chuck E. Cheese? Laura and Greg, have you seen the story about Chuck E. Cheese that's on the internet?
I'm afraid.
You have, Laura?
Yeah, the logo? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Okay,
so obviously there's a lot of people ordering stuff, more so even now maybe, right, than before on apps like Grubhub, right? So apparently Chuck E. Cheese was trying to pull a fast one on people. Chuck E. Cheese realized that people didn't want to order takeout from Chuck E. Cheese. Because if you go on like Grubhub or Postmates or whatever, like you'll find Chuck E. Cheese on there if you want it.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was they changed their information on Grubhub to something called Pasquale's Pizza. And they tricked a bunch of people into ordering Chuck E. Cheese pizza instead of because they named it Pasquale's. Now, just so you know, I don't know how much history you know about Chuck E. Cheese, but Pasquale is one of the characters in the Rat Band for Chuck E. Cheese. So that's all they did. They just changed the name to Pasquale's, and a bunch of people ordered what they thought was probably like legitimate real deal Italian pizza because they saw it was Pasquale's, and what they got was Chuck E. Cheese pizza.
Oh, no. I mean, if anybody has kids and has been to Chuck E. Cheese, that pizza is terrible.
I mean you don't kids go to love it, but it's not good pizza for adults. No.
You don't go to Chuck E. Cheese for the pizza. So I can understand why people wouldn't want to get Chuck E. Cheese pizza delivered. But Pasquale, hey, look, it's smart. I don't have a problem with this. Like, good for them for doing it this way and actually making some money.
Yeah, it is a little nefarious. I don't know if I would call it smart. Laura, how do you feel about Chuck E. Cheese trying to dupe people into buying their pizza?
Hey, man, get your money however you can at this point.
That's what I'm saying, Laura.
Right now, I think you need to... I mean, they got pizza. They got food. It's not like they didn't get delivered something. You know what I mean? They hustled you, for sure.
I mean, they clearly hustled you. Like, I don't know how I would be mad. 877-710-ESPN, 877-710-3776. Let's go to the phones here. Rod in Norwalk. Rod, I know you wanted to talk about something else. Rod is not there? I'm sorry, Mitch. Mitch, how would you feel if you thought you were ordering real deal Italian pizza and what showed up at your place was Chuck E. Cheese pizza?
I would send it back. How you doing, George? Are you being safe?
Yeah, buddy.
Let me get the mask off. I think I'm safe from you in a few thousand miles here. I would send it back, and I wouldn't. Maybe I'll give him a tip.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Right, you tip the driver. It's not his fault, and you'd send it back. Yeah, I would send it back, too. I would call Grubhub or email Grubhub and be like, yo, this is nonsense. I'm with you. That's a good idea.
Best pizzas in the East Coast there, brother.
What do you got? What else were you chiming in about? Sorry.
That's all right. I would say that this team, the Celtics, I know they won 10, 11 championships, but they were just old age and retired. This team was broken up over pettiness.
You're saying the Bulls.
I would have loved to see the Lakers with the worthy years and Shaq and Kobe. Had they, been a little smarter, they could have had the same amount of run or won more championships than the Bulls. I'm not a Jordan fan, as you can tell, and I think LeBron's the best ever. Remember, he's also a better rebounder.
Rebounding, that is a good one, too. Thanks for the call, Mitch. Stay safe. So, yeah, look, I think that was it broken up by pettiness? Yeah, I think that played a part in it. But I also think that they were getting old, right? Like, Greg, you and I were talking about it earlier. Rodman played for the Lakers the next year, and he played 35 games.
Is that what it was, 35
yeah.
games?
Because it, like
it felt
that.
Like it was like three. The only thing I remember from Jordan, or not Jordan, as Rodman as a Laker, was him being kicked out of games and throwing his jersey into the stands every single game because he got kicked out basically every game.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't fun. Like, it wasn't ideal. I just don't know. And again, if it's just him and Scotty and Tony, I don't know if that's enough to win the championship, right? Like, it's a good place to start, but I don't know if it's enough.
Yeah, I mean, but like we were talking about earlier, if anybody was going to fix that team and put a good team around them, I actually believe that Jerry Krause would have done that if he was, he would have been able to put aside his differences with all of them, because that was a huge part of the issues that they had.
Laura, do me a favor. Find me the Brian Windhorst sound that we played earlier, because I want to get Greg's thoughts on this, and we'll open it up to the audience too. So there's talk about the NBA bringing the amnesty back, which means all of a sudden the Lake, an offseason that was going to be kind of stinky because it wasn't really all that interesting. It was basically Anthony Davis's free agency, which wasn't really going to be much of a free agency, could get more interesting simply because the reality is the revenue is going to come down for the NBA next season. So when they start figuring out the offseason, they're going to have to figure out creative ways to get teams to actually sign players under whatever salary cap they decide to use, right? Like whatever that number is going to be is not going to be what we had projected, you know, a few months ago. So it's going to be lower. So in order to have player mobility, you're going to have to kind of create avenues for teams to add players to their rosters. And the amnesty clause, having that mulligan like we had, you know, back in 2012 or 13 or whatever it was, 14, I think that's a perfect way to do it. Plus, you can get the Clippers and Lakers fighting each other over guys like Blake Griffin or Chris Paul or whoever, you know, because I think that those are the type of guys you're looking at with this amnesty clause. But Brian Windhorst on his podcast, The Hoop Collective, had this to say about it.
With the possibility that the salary cap and luxury tax line may fall because of the reduced revenues, they would allow a one-time thing where you could waive a player and he comes off of your books. You still actually got to pay the salary. In a lot of cases, the players' contracts are set up that if that happens, the salary gets paid over a number of years. But that you could basically waive a player and basically get a get-out-of-jail-free card. We don't know for sure if it's going to happen. We just know that it's something the teams are talking about as a possibility. And oh my gosh, if that happens, this was going to be a pretty lame free agency. If that happens, guys, we could see some big-time action.
I love it. Let's do it. Let's go. I mean, don't even think twice about this. If you're Adam Silver, if you're the owners, hell, if you're the players, you want this. The players are still going to get their money, but you would have a real problem with free agency just based on the salary cap number and the luxury tax number and what that's going to look like if you don't do this. This creates an avenue that not only creates player mobility, but creates the flexibility that you're going to need under a potential new salary cap that's going to probably be a lot lower. So I just think it solves everybody's problems. So, Greg, Chris Paul or Blake Griffin? Who do you want on the Lakers?
Well, first of all, Blake Griffin should never touch a Laker uniform. Blake Griffin is... No, thank you on Blake Griffin. He's injured too often. He's not the same guy that he
You'd get him as a minimum player in this scenario.
Yeah, but like, where's he going to play? You're going to move Anthony Davis away from the four? You're going to bring him off the bench?
Anthony Davis is just a five. It's not like, let's be real. Like, he's not really a four.
He's going
to play the four. He likes to be announced as the four. He's not really. He's going to, I mean, whatever. You need versatility.
Yeah, well, if you want to get it, you do. But Blake, no thank you on Blake Griffin. Now, what's interesting is the Chris Paul thing is that, I mean, he's a legit MVP candidate this year. I think you voted for him third.
I would have voted for him third, yes.
Right. So if they amnestied Chris Paul, which you can't do for right now, but then you would bring him over to the Lakers and let him play with his buddy. That's pretty interesting to me. And like, so with this whole thing, how does it work? Can the Lakers then sign him to some deal and then just amnesty him also?
No. You get one amnesty. You get that. That's it. Like, you get one shot.
Each team. Each TAM. Correct. Each team. So
each TAM?
Team, yeah, whatever. Each team.
Yes, but like, you can't sign him and then amnesty him. Why would you amnesty someone on a minimum contract?
All right, well, I mean, at the end of the year, be like, oh, if you're going to sign him for a minimum contract.
No, the whole point would be to get rid of one of your bad contracts. What the hell would you do that for? You'd be a terrible general manager.
No, because I'm not talking about Oklahoma City. The Lakers don't have some terrible contract that they want
to. There isn't a contract you'd want to amnesty if you were the Lakers, not one?
Right now, no. I mean, I can't think of one.
Rondo?
Most of their contracts are. Okay, well, Rondo is a whole nother story. Yes, Rondo is a whole nother story.
Well, but isn't he only signed for 1 year? Is he signed
for 1 year? Yeah, exactly. Like, all, Yeah. No, he's not. So those are all these little – they signed all these small deals that just – there's nobody worth amnestying. But – so, I mean
– amnesty.
Could you imagine yeah, amnesting. Like buddies, though. You're talking about LeBron and Chris Paul.
Right, but
very
Chris
good
Paul
– playing with the other.
Chris Paul likes to have the ball in his hands a lot.
I think for a championship, Chris Paul will do what he needs to do alongside of LeBron, right?
It's for one season.
And getting out of the second round – yeah, for one season, get out of the second round for the first time ever, win a championship.
That's not true. Now he has been out of the first round, out of the second round.
I said the second. When was he out of the second
round? He played in a conference finals. Do you remember his hamstring went out? That's, you know, a lot of people think that's the reason the Rockets lost. Did you forget that?
Yes.
Against the Warriors? That wasn't the second round. That was the conference finals.
Was he on that team at that time?
Of course. I mean, are you serious? Like, you didn't remember?
Yeah, you're.
His
hamstrings
went out.
His hamstrings always go out.
He didn't play.
He gets injured in the most important time of the year every year.
Okay.
This is what happens.
That, all right. Anyway, what? So you think it would work?
I think it could work, but I think Amin made a great point about having the ball in the hand when you were saying the exact same thing. I just think that he would be able to step back a little bit in these situations.
All right. I mean, he did it for Harden.
To get the championship.
He did it for Harden. He didn't love it, clearly, but he did it for Harden. And maybe for a ring for one season, he would do it. It would extend LeBron's opportunity to win another championship beyond this season, which would be good. I do agree with that. Larry in Temecula. Larry, what do you think about all the things we've been talking about? I don't know if you're calling in about Chuck E. Cheese. I don't know if you're calling in about the amnesty and maybe a Chris Paul reunion. Like, what? Go ahead. Just go ahead. The floor is yours.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, Chuck E. Cheese, first of all, is not why I called. But yeah, I mean, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that to people, particularly people that have eaten Chuck E. Cheese and they really have no intentions of ever buying Chuck E. Cheese pizza. But anyways, that's not why I called. I have a completely different take. In fact, I've really never heard anybody throw this out there before. But on Michael Jordan, as per the greatest of all time, you know, the difference between Michael, Kobe, and LeBron, it's always going to be arguable. And those three guys, you know, are 1A, B, and C in any order you put them in. But here's my take. My take is that in life, timing is everything. Mm-hmm. Now, having come out of the footwear industry for 34 years and having spent most of my life in marketing, I would make the argument that Air Jordan could have been Air Bryant or Air James. Because at that time that Jordan came into the league, his David Falk, his manager, made a brilliant move hooking him up with Nike, who was obviously an incredible marketing machine. And if that had been Kobe Bryant instead of Michael Jordan, we would be talking today, is Michael Jordan equal to Kobe Bryant? Because the fact is Nike created a worldwide brand and a huge push for Michael Jordan. Not taking anything away.
Oh, Larry.
He got so much push from Nike.
Oh, no, he did. Timing is everything, right? To your point, and thank you for the call. I do think that plays a role in it for sure. But if Kobe would have come up at that time or LeBron, they would have been that. I do think you're right because I think that just how dynamic they were, both from a playing standpoint and a personality standpoint. All right, we'll take more of your calls here in a second. Let me grab who else. Who's been on hold real quick before we go to Andrea Kramer? Steve in North Hollywood. Steve, what do you got?
Yeah, hey, Jorge Chiazet in Argentina. Okay.
Hey, ¿qué pasa?
So my thing is the amnesty thing. You know who I would do is who's still on the books from them now. I don't know if they could do it because they already did it, I think, once. It's a little dang. He still makes $6 million a year.
Well, I think they stretched him, right? They stretched him. I don't know how that would work. That might be a little extra complicated, but that is an interesting one. You're right, because that little extra could get you a role player or whatever. So yeah, that's a good one. Thank you for the call.
He makes more than Rondo. So yeah.
Oh yeah, might want to. Did he curse? I don't know if he did or didn't. But Steve, we appreciate the call. you cursed. It's okay. I think you cursed, but we just have to be safe. And sorry. We appreciate you cursing. It wasn't at us. It was just in regular conversation. All right. Speaking of great conversation, Andrea Kramer covered Michael Jordan for ESPN and NBC Sports. She's been on The Last Dance. She's been pretty much in every episode. We will talk to her about all these things, Last Dance. One more round with her coming up in 3 minutes. Sedano with you here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance and brought to us by our friends at AT&T. Andrea Kramer will be joining us here, the great Andrea Kramer, giving us the Straight Talk, brought to you by Straight Talk Wireless, no contract, no compromise. And of course, if you missed any one of our interviews today, including Will Perdue, who was on with us just a little while ago, check out the entire interview on demand section of the Sedano Show podcast, brought to you by Capital One. With Capital One, you can open a new checking or savings account with no fees or minimum. Welcome to Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Approval required. Capital One N.A. Member FDIC. So Andrea Kramer joins us here one more time. We appreciate the time, Andrea. Thank you so much for joining us. And all right, so it's over now, right? We've now seen a number of different sides of Michael Jordan. I would say, though, and you kind of alluded to this when we had you on last week, that we saw at least a more mortal side or a more human side of Michael. What did you make of some of the stuff we saw over the last two episodes?
By the way, this is now 2 weeks in a row. People are going to start talking about us here. We have to be careful. No, I'm only kidding. It's great to be back on with you. I think that one of my biggest takeaways is for all of the, and I say this sort of semi-tongue-in-cheek here, but for all of these otherworldly athletic gifts and skills that have been on display that some of us have seen over the years, but some, as we've discussed before, some of the younger generation is not. For all of those, I think that we saw that Jordan is indeed human in the sense that he has all kinds of ranges of emotions from extreme anger to extreme, the emotion that he showed when his dad died and coming back and playing the first game and just, you know, sobbing uncontrollably on the floor after the win. And I just think we've seen the different sides of him emotionally that do prove that, you know what, people are multifaceted. They have a number of different sides to them. And I think that overall, Jordan was pretty true to who he was throughout this 10-episode, 10-part series.
You know what I also took away from this, and we only saw him for a brief moment at the beginning of, I believe, episode 5, which was Kobe Bryant. And, you know, Ian Thompson has a great book called The Soul of Basketball. And in there, he talks to Kobe about his relationship with Michael. And Kobe says, look, 90% of what I learned is from Michael, like directly, like literally him and I having these conversations. And the more I watched the documentary, the more I really understood that relationship that we, most of us really only found out about when Michael spoke while eulogizing him. So the one thing, though, that sticks out the most about that is that Michael was this tough guy behind the scenes, right, with teammates. And in front of the cameras, for the most part, he was pretty PC, right? Like he gave you standard answers. Whereas with Kobe, when he became Kobe 24, let's call it, I think that Kobe embraced all that stuff with Michael, but just emoted it outwardly. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Well, there's a lot of unpack in that. I think, you know, one of the things that Kobe said, Kobe has talked about over the years, is that he would literally watch video of Michael, not just on the court, but off the court. At some point early in Kobe's career, if you remember, even his verbal tics and intonation were reminiscent of Jordan. And, you know, ironic considering, of course, that they ended up with the same head coach, which won them both an awful lot of rings. But I think that Kobe's desire to emulate Michael, the difference is that they just had different upbringings. No matter what, Michael was a kid from North Carolina, cut by his junior high school team, couldn't even make it in basketball. And then you've got Kobe, who was, you know, grew up in Italy, the son of a pro, a prodigy his entire life, never went to college, you know, went right from Lower Merion High School. So their backgrounds were so different. And at some point, no matter how much Kobe wanted to literally be like Mike, he was his own person based on his own personal experiences, even if they were only for 18 or so years. So it's Kobe could try to be like Michael, but at some point he was still going to be himself. And that is a person who was developed in a very different way growing up as he did and where he did.
Andrea Kramer, the great Andrea Kramer, joining us here. You can check her out on Real Sports. Tuesday, May 26th, Real Sports is back at 7 Pacific on HBO and re-airs throughout the month. You can stream all Real Sports on HBO Go and HBO Now. We'll get into that a little later as well, as we did the last time. So let me ask you about Phil, though. You brought Phil up, which was a great point. When you were around the team, the Bulls, how would you assess the way Phil treated Michael juxtaposed to the way he would treat the rest of the team?
I think that the most amazing thing that Phil did was to get Michael to buy into the triangle. And I don't know that people, and we saw it earlier in the series and trying to explain exactly what it was, but it was sort of the... It was an offensive philosophy that was basically the antithesis of what Doug Collins had, who was obviously Phil's predecessor, was running with Michael. With Doug, it was, I can't get the ball into Michael's hands enough. Every play's got to go to Michael. Every play's got to go through Michael. It's Michael, Michael, Michael. And, you know, when you're the best player on the planet and establishing yourself as such, that may make sense. How many titles did they win? Phil comes in with his background. And one of the things that he had to do was to make everybody buy in, including Michael. Michael Jordan, who, remember, says there is no I in team, but there is an I in win. And now you've got to get him to buy into your philosophy, because Michael, yes, he carried the team. It was Michael and the Jordanaires. But the reality is that Michael still needed everybody else to step up, to contribute in their own ways, and it couldn't just be him. It was never one versus five on the court. And Phil got him to buy in. I believe it. I may be in the minority here. I actually think Phil Jackson is underrated for what he did. It makes me crazy when I hear, oh, anybody could have won with Michael Jordan. Oh, did they? Did they win with Michael Jordan before Phil got there? Oh, anybody could have won with Kobe and Shaq. Really? Okay, how many titles did they win before Phil arrived? So Phil just had this unbelievable way of relating to people. You know, Phil used to give books to people. You want a good laugh, in fact?
Sure.
So, you know, Phil used to, he would come up with reading choices for players, right? Do you know about that?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So last week I was talking to Phil on the phone. We were catching up and comparing notes on the series. Before I get off the phone, he says to me, oh, are you familiar with the such and such reading series? And it's called Wolf Hall, and it's written by a woman named Hilary Mantel. And Phil is telling me all about it, and I should be reading it, and it would be really interesting. And all of a sudden I go, oh my God, you're still making reading recommendations to people. And we both kind of laughed about it. But that's who Phil is. Yeah. I mean, he was going to do that. And when I was at his house for Real Sports, you know, I'm the only journalist he ever let come out to Montana and visit him. And in the house, he's burning all the incense that he did when he was back at the Bulls. And he is who he is. And it's kind of like what we talked about with Jordan. They're their own unique people, and they're not going to change for anybody. And Phil didn't in terms of coaching Michael.
Andrea, there was some reporting that Scotty wasn't necessarily thrilled with the way he was portrayed in the documentary. How did you view the way Scotty was portrayed?
Well, I saw that as well. I have not spoken to Scotty, so I don't know firsthand his thoughts. But I'm going to say this, George. When given the opportunity to discuss not going into the game with 1.8 seconds left when Phil diagrammed the play for Tony Kukoc to take the last shot against the Knicks. When presented with that, and that became a whole talking point in the story, Scotty said, if I had to do it all over again, I would do the same thing. I literally leapt from my chair and said, what?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Are you serious? Because looking back on things, there's ways to say it. You know what? I've had a Hall of Fame career. I'm incredibly grateful for that. You know, all the things that I accomplished and I won. But you know what? If there's one thing that I learned I would have done differently, it's understanding about being the team player. But he didn't do that. So truthfully, I don't want to hear that you didn't like the way you're portrayed. You portrayed yourself in a certain way. And that's I've always been an action, not words kind of person. So don't tell me, show me. And what Scotty showed there is, with that comment, is that he still doesn't get it after all these years. Just my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt the exact same way you did when I saw that a couple of weeks ago. Last one on the documentary, the Steve Kerr story yesterday. I thought it was excellent storytelling and the way they tied everything in from beginning to end, including the stuff with his father, which, look, I was familiar with. But I would say, Andrea, it hit different when you're watching him and his mom, right, tell that story. Mm-hmm. How familiar were you with Steve's background when you were covering them?
Well, I don't know how familiar I was when I was covering them. Obviously, over the years, I have, you know, learned quite a bit about the story from Steve and from others. Steve, I give credit to Jason Hare, to the documentarian, the director, because Steve has always, always, always been extremely reticent to talk about his dad's assassination. And you talk about great storytelling. Not only great storytelling in terms of developing the backstories of various characters, such as in this case Steve Kerr, but managing to weave the personal narratives into the narrative of the Bulls' run. And so here you are leading into what was the crowning achievement of Steve Kerr's career as a Chicago Bull, and then they give you the backstory. So from a journalistic storytelling perspective, I thought that was absolutely masterful the way they did that. And listen, I think that this is, whether it's Steve Kerr, Michael Jordan, the deaths of their fathers, and it was interesting when Kerr said that he and Michael had never really, quote-unquote, compared notes on that, had never talked about their respective losses in that respect. But I think that it was so powerful to hear Steve talk about it and to see, again, how moved he was by that horrible event, just as Michael was in so many ways, and how both men thrust themselves into their sport, into basketball, to try to fill that void and to try to, you know, cover up the wound that existed for them. So I'm agreeing with you. I think it was just brilliant storytelling on Steve Kerr and perfectly woven into the narrative of the Bulls' run as well.
The great Andrea Kramer joining us here. Of course, you can check out Real Sports Tuesday, May 26th, which is coming up next week, 7 o'clock Pacific, and re-airs throughout the month. You can stream Real Sports on HBO Go and HBO Now. So last week, we talked to you a little bit about the story you were working on, which is a follow-up with Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, the Chiefs offensive lineman. I think I did a much better job this time around pronouncing his name. I don't know if I did it right or not, but I think I was much closer this time.
You been practicing?
I may. I needed to impress you, Andrea. As I told you before, you know, I certainly grew up adoring you and Dan, as we talked about, and Charlie Steiner and all them. I wanted to make sure I impressed you this time around. But anyway,
old, but that's okay. I appreciate it.
I did have a specific. You're not. You're great. I wanted to ask you a specific question that I didn't get a chance to ask you last time about this story that you're running on the 26th, which is how he, as someone who's a scholar, right, and is the only NFL player who doubles as a physician, as well as an offensive lineman or an NFL player, how he's received within the locker room construct. I'm curious to hear about that.
How he's received all around, or right now, you mean, because of what he's doing?
No, just in general, like how guys in that locker room feel about a guy who's a doctor also happens to play with them. Like,
well,
just the randomness
the
of that.
One thing that Laurent is very he's very cognizant of is never to overstep his bounds with the medical and the training personnel of the Chiefs. So it was interesting because so on Thursday Night Football, for Hennestrom and my broadcast on Amazon, we had the Chiefs game in which Patrick Mahomes dislocated his kneecap. And I had talked to Laurent after that, and I said, did you know? He goes, oh, I knew immediately. And I knew what it was, and it was just kind of funny to hear that here he is, you know, charged with protecting the quarterback, and then when he looks back and he sees his kneecap, and he immediately knew that it was dislocated. Even when Laurent himself injured his knee, the doctors come over. He had actually been mic'd during the game, And Laurent actually says, it's my MCL, which is just kind of funny because he got hurt and then he diagnosed himself. But the players, he's very, very careful. They have tremendous respect for him, but he's very careful not to overstep his bounds if they were to ask questions or anything like that. What also was interesting is that in talking to some of his teammates, I figured they would be most concerned about, okay, you're a doctor, you're this, you're that. What concerns do you have about head injuries? But as one of his teammates pointed out, he was more thinking, what about your hands? Because if you've ever seen particularly a lineman's hands, if you hold your hand out, the pinky could be kind of like looking like an L there and not sticking straight ahead. So, you know, your digits, especially as a lineman, can absolutely get destroyed, your hands. And this player said to me, wow, I mean, if you're going to be a surgeon, I'd be really concerned about his hands and his dexterity and things of that nature. So I hadn't thought about that, but I thought it was a great point. They, if anything, they're very proud of him, but also concerned because a lot of guys maybe can't do something else, and here's somebody who absolutely can do something else and still is that devoted to football that he wants to continue to play despite having a medical degree.
It's a fascinating story. You can check it out on Real Sports coming up a week from tomorrow, Tuesday, May 26th at 7 Pacific. Re-airs throughout the month, of course, and you can stream all the Real Sports episodes on HBO Go and HBO Now. Andrea Kramer, thank you so much for coming back the following week here to talk to us about The Last Dance and talk to us about your stories on Real Sports. A pleasure, an honor. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, but don't be a stranger now. Just
no,
basketball is going away.
We need to talk to you more often. I want to do this way more often, for sure.
Take good care. Stay healthy. Stay healthy, most importantly.
You too. Take care, Andrea. There she is, Andrea Kramer, one of the best in the business. Certainly an honor to have her on here. All right, we got a quick break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. I got one more thing, including a long list of things that Major League Baseball wants to address to play safely. We'll tell you what those are in just a moment. Stick around. Back in less than three on The Sedano Show, 710 ESPN. Sedano over here on 710 ESPN, presented by Progressive Insurance. Listen to the shower sessions, easy for you to say. Listen to the shower sessions, part interview, part concert, all from the shower. Grammy winner St. Vincent invites up-and-coming artists to sing and share and get funky, all in the sound booth at home, the shower. Watch now on youtube.com/progressive. So thanks to Andrea Kramer for joining us there. Thanks to Will Perdue for joining us a little earlier. By the way, I mentioned the Ian Thompson book, The Soul of Basketball. I have it. I hadn't read it completely until recently, and it really is worth your time if you want to read it. I know I referenced it a couple of times here over the show today, but definitely check it out. And also check out the Warriors one, which is the Winning Machine with our buddy Ethan Strauss, who came on with Ramona and I a couple of weeks ago. That thing is really fascinating too. So anyway, people are loving Andrea Kramer. Even Beto Duran tweeted, yo, more Kramer. We'll try to get her back on. I think we can just go to her directly now, Greg, right? We don't think we need to go through her people anymore.
Yeah, I can go directly to her now.
Yeah, she's great.
Which is nice. Oh, she's fantastic.
Yeah. So, Greg, tell me about the laundry list of stuff Major League Baseball has here to get back to playing baseball.
So, no more. These ones are fine. No high fives, no fist bumps, no hugs are now prohibited. As would spitting, using tobacco, or chewing sunflower seeds, which is a little bit odd.
You can't spit, bro. What if you spit and it hits somebody? Like that's. There's wind. Has that ever happened to you when you spit? You spit in the wind and it hits you back. Even your own spit. Like that's not fun.
You do that one time. You never want to do that a second time.
Well, I'm just saying, like it can happen. You know, it's in the air. Once it's in the air, it's airborne.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sunflower seeds. It's going to be difficult for them. But here's the biggest part of it. Okay. Fielders would be encouraged to retreat several steps away from the base runner between pitches. And so I think that's the biggest one because, what, you can't hold on a mentally, player at first base now?
Mentally, that's going to be tough. Yeah, there might be. It might be challenging, right? Like, I think that there's suggestions, right? I think that there's, in that case, that's a suggestion. I don't know if that's a legit strict rule guideline.
Encouraged.
Yeah, encouraged. Right. It's a suggestion. So, yeah, it's up to you whether you want to hold the guy first. But the reality is this, Greg. The other part of the equation is that, you know, these guys are going to be tested regularly. So once they're in the bubble, if they're going to be playing in their bubbles, if that's what even happens, because we don't even know if that's happening yet, or if they're going to play in their stadiums, I think that if they're playing in a bubble scenario, then I think holding guys on at first becomes easier because you know that you're all in the same quarantine together. If you're playing at different stadiums, I could see where I'd be like, I don't know about that.
Right. I mean, because if you're just not doing that, then basically guys like Trey Turner are going to run for 250 stolen bases. It's going to be insane.
Yeah, you know, you haven't really had stolen bases in a long time because of analytics. So what the hell? You
know? Right. And then there's this one. A ball will be thrown away after it is touched by multiple players. So every single pitch?
Yeah. That's easy, though. That's an easy
pitch.
So fix.
Every pitch, you're going to throw a ball away every single time you touch a ball.
No. But, when it goes into the field and someone touches it.
Well, okay.
The pitcher and catcher will be playing, and in theory, those two guys hopefully will have been tested where they're okay. But yeah, so if you had to use a ball every time, so be it.
All right, but that's a pitcher, a catcher, and then a lot of times the umpire is a part of that as well. And then if it goes into the outfield or anywhere, you're not allowed to throw ball around the bases either. It's just a very strange situation that it's just not.
Oh,
baseball.
Get over it. It's not. We're dealing with a strange situation. Okay.
Sure. Sure we are. It's just like you're taking away from the game. If, like you said, the mental aspect of it is very, very different.
Yeah, you'll get used to it. It's fine.
If a player, though, is thinking about so many things in every single at-bat and every single pitch that adding, I got to be 6 feet away from this guy.
Well, you can still – even if you throw it by accident, you can catch it, the other guy, with your glove and then just toss it from your glove. Like, it's not that hard.
Yeah, because it's not that hard to just throw from the outfield from your glove.
No, what I'm saying is you could toss the ball away, and that way the ball's no longer in play, you doofus. Like, that's what I'm saying.
This is just – it's very insane. It's not baseball.
Oh, there we go. So do you want no baseball then?
I do want baseball,
okay,
but I want it to actually be baseball.
Because here's what I'm going to tell you. You're already doing it, and people are going to do it. They're going to complain. And you know what? If you're going to complain, then that's on you, okay? By the way, you know what else is going to be different? And this one will be funny, too. Jeff Passan, Laura, on the ways that things will be different, including post-game.
Baseball as we know it is going to change. Now, it's going to change in really small ways sometimes, Hannah. You're not allowed to spit. You're not allowed to have sunflower seeds on the field. One thing that got a really visceral reaction was the point that we will discourage players from showering after the game. That didn't go over well, and the MLBPA, as well as Major League Baseball executives, are going to have their chance to voice some of those concerns, and it can be everything as simple as, hey, we want to take a shower after the game, to, hey, it doesn't exactly say what happens to me if I test positive on the road.
All right, so stinky baseball players. We'll discuss that further tomorrow. Thanks to Laura. Thanks to Greg. Thanks to you guys for tuning in. Thanks to Andrea Kramer, Will Perdue, and Amin for joining us today. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 10. Stay safe. Stay healthy. We love you.